Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of September 8th. We were joined this week by Professor Uwe Reinhardt from Princeton University, an expert on healthcare and healthcare reform. He has an article in the September 8th issue called The True Cost of Care. We began by asking Professor Reinhardt to describe for us the difference between socialized medicine and social health insurance.
The confusion arises over who owns the production facility. By socialized medicine, we mean a system in which the government owns the delivery side, particularly the hospitals, sometimes the clinics, and also finances the system. The classic illustration used to be the British National Health Service or the health services of the Soviet republics, or in the United States, what we reserve for veterans, which is a purely socialized medicine, the Veterans Administration health system, which incidentally is said to be sort of at the cutting edge of the use of IT, information technology, and quality assurance, which is somewhat ironic that Americans decry socialized medicine but reserve it for their veterans. That's socialized medicine. Social insurance is simply an arrangement whereby individuals can roll over risks they face to society as a whole, usually through the government. Classic example is the Bismarck-styled social health insurance, which we have in the form of Medicare for the elderly and Medicaid for the poor, where an elderly American rolls over the financial risk of illness to the government as a whole through Medicare. But the delivery is from a mixed system of non-profit and for-profit institutions. Nothing there is socialized at all. It's only the insurance side. The banking system runs essentially on a social, quasi-social insurance model, because as you read now, more and more the federal government through the Fed or the Treasury is bailing out the banking industry. And that's a form of social insurance where an individual bank that screws up can roll over the risk of that onto the taxpayer as a whole. That's social insurance. And then, of course, private insurance is different from that, where you actually pay a premium that is based essentially on the risk you face. So if you're sick, you pay a higher premium than if you're chronically healthy. That's private insurance that's based on actuarially calculated premiums. Social insurance, generally your contributions are based on ability to pay.
Now, the system we have set up now is one in which most people have insurance through their employers. What are the problems inherent in that system?
Well, the problems inherent in the private insurance covers about 65% of the population. Most of the, of course, all under 65. And only 10% of that cohort is insured by buying individual policy. Most are at the place of work. The problem is that each company is its own risk pool. So if you're a large company, like GM, that's really a sort of privatized, socialized insurance. But if you're a small company with, say, 20 employees, and one or two are very sick, one may have AIDS, the other one cancer, that becomes the risk pool, and the premiums of that small employer can go way up just because one or two members are very sick. Secondly, a problem with employment-based insurance is that you lose it with your job. So if in, say, take Wall Street, which is now massively contracting, and thousands of people were fired as a result of essentially the mess their bosses made. Now, these guys have the right with their own money to buy into their employer's insurance for another 18 months. That's called COBRA. But thereafter, they're on their own. So if they don't get a new job with new insurance coverage within 18 months, these people are without insurance, although they're upper middle class. So it's a temporary insurance that is lost with the job. Just when you're in the worst fiscal shape, you lose your health insurance. And then, of course, in addition, it's extremely expensive to run. We spend more on administration in this country in healthcare than any other nation on earth.
Now, that's, you mentioned GM, and although their cost perhaps might be lower than a smaller company, companies like that are among those who are starting to lobby for national health insurance because, as I understand it, the cost would be that the government with the other parties would start to assume that cost rather than the private corporations, and that because it can be a huge cost factor.
Right. This, in fact, is more obvious to the GMs of this world than to any other company because they also have manufacturing facilities in Canada. And they notice that they're not stuck with health insurance. They pay general corporate taxes, right? But so does any other corporation. Mm-hmm. But they do not have to pay for the health care of their workers up there. So I recently heard a speaker allude to a report that said an awful lot of manufacturing of car parts has actually shifted from the U.S. across the border to Canada because it's cheaper to make it there because the labor is cheaper because you don't have to pay for the health care of the workers. You could see why the Rust Belt companies with a lot of older workers, with a lot of retirees, would basically have the government take care of health insurance for people. And of course, if you did this, this would make our labor markets a lot more efficient and a lot more fluid because a lot of people stick to jobs that they hate and which they're not productive, mainly because they get health insurance there. It's called the job lock. There is no such thing as job lock in Canada.
Right, there was a story in the New York Times recently about some people who get married just purely for one of the principal reasons is in order to get health insurance.
Yeah, that's correct, yeah.
Now, you mentioned Canada, also in Europe, which you write about in your article, examples of systems where the government is obviously heavily involved with social health insurance. What are the differences between the United States and Europe here? Why is it so hard to pass that kind of reform in this country?
The Europeans just have different cultural traditions. The way I put it, they are genuine nations, you know, at least so far still are. Where when you're a Frenchman, you think you're French. And if you're a German, you know that, and you look after each other. But the U.S. is a nation in name only. In many ways, we're really just Texans and New Jerseyites and Louisianites. I don't think there is this national feeling. You have it in the Olympics. You have it on July 3rd or when we conduct wars. But even when it comes to wars, we're not really a nation anymore. I mean, we delegate the fighting of wars to the few volunteers who go and do it. But there are very few young Americans who would stand up for their nation anymore. I don't think we're really a nation in the sense that I have some experience. I lived in Germany. I grew up there. I lived in Canada, and I've lived here. And I always say, this is the country where I least feel that I'm in a nation. There, I really had a feeling I'm in a nation. Canadian, you're a Canadian. You feel that way.
Now, there has been at least one state experimenting with mandatory health insurance, and that's Massachusetts.
Yes,
well, maybe you can just kind of bring us up to speed on how that's...
Well, the idea, and what they really did is saying, we take the existing system, and instead of revolutionizing it, we're just filling in the gaps. And so for small businesses, there was no institution that they could look for to structure health insurance for their employees. See, a large company has a benefit department, it's part of the personnel department, and they can contract and order for the employees a menu of choices of health insurance. But the benefit department negotiates all that, and these are seasoned, experienced, professional people. When you have a small company with 20 people, they don't have any leverage in the insurance market, and they don't have the personnel to designate just to deal with health insurance. So there was no institution that small businesses and their employees could look to help them pick insurance. And so they created such an institution called the Connector, which is really like a huge farmer's market where small employers and their employees can go to buy health insurance, and the Connector those people, they have savvy and they have leverage to negotiate good prices and good conditions with the health insurance company. So that was what they legislated. Plus, they pumped in a bunch of subsidies for low-income people to buy insurance at the connector. And then they expanded Medicaid a little bit and so on. So they basically built on the existing system, constructed somebody who is a substitute for the benefit department of small business firms so that they would have the same advantages a large employer like GM would have or like Harvard would have. And it was very clever. And I believe, so far, this thing is working. I've been up there and talked to the people. And that could, of course, be used as a model nationwide, where every state would run a thing like this. Problem is, Massachusetts had only about 13% uninsured, and it's one of the richest states in the union. You go to Louisiana, or Texas even, 25% of the population is uninsured, and a lot of these states, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, they're not rich. They're very poor states. So the only way you could run that system down there would be with sizable federal subsidies. The Clinton plan, Hillary Clinton's plan, was essentially a giant Massachusetts plan for the whole country with huge subsidies. She was going to spend $120 billion a year subsidizing Americans to buy insurance through these connector-like structures. And Obama's plan is somewhat similar to that, too. He also would have these connectors. So they basically were influenced by the Massachusetts plan, the Democrats' plan, and would be sort of federalized versions of that.
Now, my understanding of the difference, the primary difference between the Clinton and Obama plan was that Clinton would mandate, make it mandatory for everybody to opt into some sort of health insurance.
As it is in Massachusetts.
As it is in Massachusetts. But Obama's plan was that people would still have a choice not to. Is that still the case, or is he moving?
Yeah, it's still the case, except for children. He would make it mandatory that children must be insured, but then subsidize families, too, so they could afford it. And that's easy to do because children are cheap.
Now, do you think mandatory is the way to go, or do you think choice is a better
Well, ideally, mandatory is what you have to do if you really want universal coverage, because otherwise you could still have it where somebody chooses not to be insured, and then when they get sick, then they want to get insurance, and then if you have guaranteed issue and community rating, right, so you live in a country where the insurer must take you no matter how sick you are at a rate that's the average rate for everyone, why then, if you're healthy, would you insure? Because when you're sick, you can get insurance on favorable terms. So, to some extent, I know why Obama did it. He didn't want to give the Republicans an opening of saying, look at the Soviet approach to life, right? So he can say, look, it's voluntary. But the truth of the matter is, in the longer run, such systems don't work. You have to have it mandatory. Or you have to have substantial penalties on people who come and insure late.
Now, finally, you've been studying this issue for a long time. It's again on the national stage. What do you think are the chances of we actually getting this done at some point in the next couple of years?
I mean, there are some people who are hopeful that if you had a majority in the House and had 60 votes in the Senate, that in fact you would see substantial progress. And I'm telling you, there is one little bellwether that you might use to sort of nourish your optimism. Yesterday, the numbers came out from the Census Bureau that said that the number of uninsured had fallen from 47 to 45.7 million, right? Now, it turns out, even the Wall Street Journal admitted in the editorial today, that the entire increase in the number of the insured was not in the private sector, it was Medicaid. In other words, the number of uninsured fell because the number of people in Medicaid increased. And one might certainly argue that that had something to do with the Democratic Congress. I don't know if it actually did or whether it expanded just on the basis of existing legislation, I don't really know. But nevertheless, Medicaid expanded enough to reduce the number of uninsured. So given that that happened in a Democratic Congress, they would probably appropriate money to underwrite this and pay for this. But if you had, for example, McCain in the White House and then the a Democratic Congress, then the question is, would McCain initiate such legislation for the uninsured? He hasn't really said much on that. Or if the Democrats passed a very generous but expensive insurance package, would President McCain veto it? We don't know. So that's really quite uncertain.
Well, Professor Reinhardt, thank you for explaining this to us and to our listeners. And again, your article is in our September 8th issue.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the American Magazine podcast. Tune in next week when we'll have Donna Freitas back with us to discuss her new young adult novel, The Possibilities of Sainthood. Again, we'd like to thank Bill McGarvey, who provided the music for this week's show. You can learn more about him at billmcgarvey.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.